it a wonderful thing to be a Christian and to realize that the resurrection of Christ is the pledge of our resurrection and we shall live again? It's wonderful to be a Christian and have full confidence in the word that He's given to us. Studying Ezekiel, we are ready this morning for the third of seven prophecies against Egypt. This third one begins in the 30th chapter of Ezekiel and is comprised of the first 19 verses of that chapter. Very significant in this section is the fact that there are four parts to it, and each one of these sections of this prophecy begins with the language, "This is what the Sovereign Lord says," or "This is what Jehovah says," and are equivalent words. And then each of them ends with a declaration that declares the Sovereign Lord, or declares Jehovah, or "I the Lord have spoken," or some similar language. God is speaking to His people. And we'll talk more about that later, because it sounds like God is speaking to Egypt. And God is speaking to Egypt, but He's really speaking to His people. That is who He wants to hear the message that is being delivered by Ezekiel. And we'll talk about the fact that Ezekiel's message is directed to and spoken to the people of Israel. This particular prophecy against Egypt emphasizes the day of the Lord. And it is, in essence, a distress. It's not a lament as such, but it is a wail. It is a statement of distress expressed by the people, or expressed by Ezekiel on behalf of the people, because the day of the Lord is coming. Now, in our minds, we generally equate the day of the Lord with the day of final judgment. And it's certainly true that in Scripture it is often used that way. But it is also used in Scripture to designate simply a general day of judgment of people, whether it be final judgment at the end of human history or not. And in chapter 29 and verse 21 of Ezekiel, it's used to describe a day of blessing for Israel. Here, I think it's used simply as general approaching day of judgment called the time of the doom of the nations. And that is the translation in the New American Standard version, time of the doom of the nations. So Ezekiel basically is trying to get the attention of his audience. Joel used the same approach in talking about the day of the Lord. If you look at Joel chapter 1 beginning in verse 15 and going down through chapter 2 and verse 11. As the old story goes, the fellow who sold his mule, and the fellow who bought the mule couldn't get the mule to do anything. So he went back to the fellow who sold it and said, "How do I get this mule to follow my instructions?" And the guy picked up a 2x4 and hit the mule between the eyes with the 2x4, and then the mule started following instructions. And he said, "First, you've got to get his attention." So that's what Ezekiel is doing here with his language about the day of the Lord. He's getting the attention of the people to whom he is speaking. Joel did the same thing. And Ezekiel had used the same kind of description to talk about the end of Israel back in chapter 7 and the first 13 verses. Here, Ezekiel makes it very clear that this judgment that God is going to bring upon these nations would be universal, it would be international in its character. Because this sword of judgment that Ezekiel will identify as Babylon is going to bring a devastating judgment not only upon Egypt, but upon the nations that surround Egypt as well. It speaks specifically of Ethiopia. And that it's going to destroy all of them. And he says, verses 7 and 8, "When Egypt was on fire and its allies were crushed, all would know that Jehovah is God." As you've gone through these prophecies against Egypt, and as you continue to go through them, I hope that you have noticed and will continue to notice that the purpose of them is always stated toward the end, so that They will know that Jehovah is God. There is only one God. There is only one true and living God. And that's the message that God is going to give through these prophecies upon Egypt. In verses 10 to 19, continuing the same prophecy against Egypt, Ezekiel, in order to make certain that there is no misunderstanding of the identification of the sword of destruction, specifically identifies the sword as Babylon. And he says that God is going to bring destruction upon Egypt basically from two sources. Number one is going to be human, and number two is going to be by nature. The human source is going to be Nebuchadnezzar and his army. And God says, I also will dry up the Nile upon whose waters this nation has depended and upon whom it rests. And you'll remember in one of the prior prophecies against Egypt, we saw that one of the problems God had with Egypt was that it said, the Nile is mine. I have created it. I am responsible for it. And we discussed the fact that Pharaoh was not responsible for the Nile. The Nile was responsible for Pharaoh and for Egypt. And without the Nile, there would have been no Egypt, because the Nile was the source of its greatness, its commerce, and its power. God also in this section tells them, primarily verses 13 to 19, that this judgment that he's sending is going to be comprehensive and complete. It's going to go from the cities of Lower Egypt to the cities of Upper Egypt. It's going to go from the northeastern reaches of the Delta all the way down to the southern reaches of the Nile. And all of it is going to succumb to the divine devastation that God is bringing upon the land of Egypt. And you go back and you look. Maybe it really hasn't dawned on us how really marvelous the ancient civilization of Egypt actually was. They had reached extraordinary achievement for their day and their age. But the problem was that they looked upon it all as a symbol of human strength and progress. And Ezekiel's message is, it doesn't make any difference what human progress and might you have amassed, what kind of architectural accomplishments you have achieved. When God says you are gone, you are gone. Human strength, human ingenuity cannot resist the might of God. The truth of the matter is, by this time, the civilization of Egypt had been around about 2,500 years. Now, you go back in history, and you find me any nation that survived that long. Not there. The only nation that probably could rival it would have been God's people. And he had a special purpose for them. Look and see if you can find any nation that could rival its architectural accomplishments. I mean, people still go, in spite of what's going on over there, to see the pyramids. I'm not that brave. I'll just look at pictures. But they're marvels of architectural beauty and construction. And yet, where is Egypt today? You know, the Egypt that we see today is a little old weak nation that, as we mentioned last week, went under to modern Israel in a 6 days war. I mean, you talk about a blitzkrieg, those boys didn't last as long as they say a snowball in August. They were gone. The Israel we see is the Israel of prophecy, because God said, let me tell you, I'm going to strike this nation down. And when I strike it down, it will come back, but it'll be over there at Patros, and it's going to be a little old weak nation. It is never, ever again going to make the who's who of nations in this world. And it hasn't. And it won't. Because that was the message of God. This ancient civilization that had survived for centuries was as vulnerable to the judgment of God as any other nation or people. And its pride and its arrogance would be shattered and its foundations would be shaken according to the judgment of God when they were summoned to God's judgment. Let me suggest to you that the oracle against Egypt stands as a perpetual reminder of the omnipotence of God over and against the temporary potency of mankind. Well, that was Egypt. Oh, we don't think God is still God. I suggest to you that what was true of ancient Egypt is equally true of modern nations and empires. And when you look at modern nations and the accomplishments of men, there is not a single solitary one of them that is not marked by the quality of temporality, which says you're here today, but you're gone tomorrow. And what the nations of today need to learn is that the durability of a nation or a civilization doesn't depend upon the achievements of its members, either singularly or in whole. Modern nations need to learn that they are subject to the sovereignty of the true and the living God. And the qualities that lead to survival are not greatness and strength, armaments, but they're the fruits of humility and morality that emerge from the recognition of the ultimate sovereignty of the one true God, of Jehovah God, in all human affairs. Oracle number 4. Chapter 30, verses 20 to 26. We've been introduced to the day of the Lord here. Ezekiel is telling these folks that Egypt is going to be helpless in the day of the Lord. This prophecy is dated around April 29th, 587 B.C., just shortly before the final siege and defeat of Jerusalem. This adds somewhat to what has already been said. We'll not go over some of the other things that we've talked about in relationship to the prophecies. They're in the notes if you want to call them up on the website. But the important thing here is that Ezekiel says, let me tell you, Pharaoh's arm is going to be broken. Now he says, one arm's already been broken and it ain't healed. And that was, you recall, Pharaoh Hophra came over to try and help Jerusalem against Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar, sort of like the cow in the stall, switched its tail and the fly was gone. And Nebuchadnezzar left Jerusalem shortly, went, took care of Hophra, came back to Jerusalem, and continued to siege and finally take over, destroy Jerusalem. But God describes it this way. When Pharaoh went to try and help against Nebuchadnezzar, one arm was broken and it hadn't healed, and God said, I'm going to break your other arm. You're not going to have a good one. Got one bad one, sort of like I don't know how my daddy ever survived. But when I was about, I guess I was probably 4, my sister would have been 6, we moved to Itasca, Texas, where my daddy had his first full-time preaching job. He had preached part-time, I guess ever since I'd been born, but he was going down to Itasca, Texas, south of Fort Worth. There was an elder there by the name of Brother Dennis, And Brother Dennis, we like to go down to Brother Dennis's place of business. It was a lumber yard, some such, and you could have all kinds of fun down there. And he'd give me nails and all sorts of good stuff that I could get in more trouble with. But Brother Dennis just had one good eye. And we were down there one day, and my sister looked at him and said, "You just got one eye, don't you?" Well, I couldn't let it rest, and I said, "Yeah, and it's got a wart on it." So I don't know how my daddy survived, but he kept that preaching job and went on. And actually suffered his final stroke in the pulpit while preaching. But that's what God's saying about Pharaoh here. You just got one good arm, and I'm fixing to break it. It's going to be gone. Now, if you go back and look at all of the ancient statues, etc., the arm was the symbol of strength. And when God says, "I'm going to break your arm," that means your strength is fixing to be gone. I'm going to take care of you. Your strength is no match for me. And this was a message to Israel that, you know, you've been dependent on this arm. Let me tell you, that arm isn't going to do you any good. But what was wrong with Israel? What was wrong with Israel was that they forgot the arm on which they should have been depending. Look at Psalm 98:1. "Oh, sing to the Lord a new song, for He has done marvelous things. His right hand and His holy arm have gotten Him victory." These folks had decided that, and we'll talk more about this later, that they could depend upon the arm of flesh. The chosen people had once been a mighty nation. But they were a mighty nation only because at that time they were depending upon and relying upon the strength of God's holy arm. And it was because they forgot the strength of that arm that they had fallen victim to the arms of their human enemies. And God said, "Those arms on which you have been relying, I'm going to use them for judgment on you, and then I'll break their arm." And that's exactly what happened. Chapters 31 and 32. Prophecies against Egypt continued. The fifth oracle against Egypt. Chapter 31, verses 1 to 18. Talk about the fall of the cedar of Egypt. And this is basically the entirety of the chapter. This message dated around June 21st, 587 BC, somewhere around the final siege of Jerusalem and its destruction. Ezekiel is prophesying against the king of Egypt, but he does it by talking about Assyria. And he describes Assyria as a tall cedar of Lebanon. It was planted in the best of environments where its roots were watered. It grew tall. It grew strong. And certainly Assyria was the strongest nation of its time before it too fell. But here Ezekiel is describing it in the days of its splendor, and he says that, you know, all of the nations round about, he describes it as birds coming to nest in the limbs. But this is the satellite nations around about that depended upon Assyria and its height and its strength and its beauty. It was such a tree that Ezekiel even says the trees in the Eden, the garden of God, Eden, were jealous of it. Now, that's simply figurative language to describe how really mighty and powerful and beautiful this tree of Assyria had become. This is a common device in the Old Testament, is to describe rulers as trees. It's not unusual at all. And I've got a number of examples of it listed in the notes if you want to look at them. The cedars of Lebanon were noted for their height, for their durability, for their beauty. And you couldn't have picked anything better than the cedar of Lebanon to describe the beauty of Assyria in its majesty and at its height. Beginning in verse 10, Ezekiel starts talking about the reasons for the fall of Assyria and Egypt. And I want you to notice the way verse 10 begins. Thus says the Lord. I'm reading the New American Standard. Probably a lot of translations there have the word therefore. And both of them are words of conclusion. One has gone before therefore. And what has happened here is that Ezekiel's prophecy has sort of lulled the reader into a state of, I hesitate to use the word indifference, but all of a sudden the door is slammed with God's therefore. God's judgment. God's message for Egypt. And it's at this point that Ezekiel moves to the declaration of judgment and demonstrates that Assyria's and also Egypt's, we'll see in a minute, strengths were also its source of weakness. Because the reason for Assyria's fall was its pride and its arrogance. And it was precisely because of Assyria's pride and arrogance, we are told in verses 10 and 11, that God determined to bring judgment upon Assyria, and to do it, coming down through verses 12 and 13, by using one of the most ruthless, tyrannical nations, cruel nations that ever existed, and that was, of course, Babylon. Depending on the translation, verse 12 describes them as ruthless, brutal. And of course, when Assyria started getting into trouble, everybody came to its rescue, didn't it? Nope. Verses 12 and 13. No. We came to you because you're strong. We leave you when you aren't. They abandoned Assyria and left it to fall. Verse 14, God says no other tree is ever going to reach such height. But verse 15 tells us that on the day it fell, God assisted in its funeral. God helped preach the sermon. The nations did tremble and mourn at the sound of its fall and descent into Sheol. And the allies that thought they would abandon it all went down with the cedar of Lebanon, verses 16 and 17. Now what's the point of it all? Verse 18. To which among the trees of Eden are you thus equal in glory and greatness? Yet you will be brought down with the trees of Eden to the earth beneath. You will lie in the midst of the uncircumcised with those who were slain by the sword. So is Pharaoh and all his multitude, declares the Lord. Everything that has been said to this point laid the foundation for the conclusion in verse 18. If Assyria, with all of its splendor and majesty and power, could not avoid the judgment of God, what shall we say about Egypt? It cannot either. And the same fate God is saying in verse 18 that befell Assyria will also befall Egypt. And whether you recognize it or not, this teaches us something, and that is death is the great equalizer and the surest antidote to excessive ambition and pride. I mean, that cures it all. When I was younger, I didn't understand. I think I do now. When my daddy used to say, there are some situations that nothing will help so much as a good first-class funeral. And that's exactly true. Let me tell you, where there's excessive pride and arrogance, it doesn't go past the grave. It ends with you right there. It is the great equalizer. It's appointed unto man once to die, and then the judgment. And even the Egypts of this world, who have success stories, despite the fact that they are wicked and evil and mean, need to be taught the lesson back up in verse 9. I made it beautiful with the multitude of its branches. Even the prosperity of the wicked, in the last analysis, is due to the mercy and the goodness of God. I made it beautiful. But instead of realizing that it came from the true and the living God, they were filled with arrogance and with pride. The story of the cedar, I think, revisits several themes that occurred in the prophecies against foreign nations. First, it revisits the theme that God hates pride because it leads people and nations to ruin and destruction. You remember the lessons that Eric taught? The prophecies against seven cities or nations, and now against Egypt, Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Oh, well then, we just have to watch ourselves and be sure that we're poor, etc. No. There's nothing wrong with being a tall tree. There's nothing wrong in and of itself with being a strong tree. What very often goes wrong is the attitude that we have toward being a strong and a tall and a beautiful tree. It's the attitude to the greatness and the strength that is crucial. You know, true greatness just comes to very few people in this world. Minor forms of greatness may come to a few more people. And greatness in and of itself is not something to be proud of, but neither is it something to be ashamed of, unless it leads to pride and conceit and despising others. And when that happens, you may not have lost your position, but you have lost your greatness. And God will bring you into judgment. Number two, the fall of the mighty is a loss to the weak. When the tree was cut down, all of the birds that rested in its branches were the losers as well. And one of the problems with conceit and pride is that folks very seldom take concern about the weak who depend upon them and who rely on them. I don't want to pass any judgments without facts, and I don't have anything but what I read in the paper. And my knowledge of what goes on in the paper, when I have been places that have been reported on, makes me wonder how accurate what I read in the paper is. But I wonder about Enron and the folks who were leading Enron. And if that might not have been different if some of those folks had been thinking about the people who depended on them. I don't know. It's just a thought. It's an illustration. But it's something to think about, isn't it? When the mighty fall, those who depend on them suffer as well. And then thirdly, the fall of the tree was a reminder of the mortality of human beings and individual accountability to God. Every one of us will give account of himself unto God for the things done in the flesh, whether it be good or whether it be evil. The pride and perversion of Egypt were its downfall, and it will be the downfall of any nation or individual who has these characteristics. This was a devastating message, I think, for the exiles. If they had any hope that Babylon was going to save them, that Egypt would save them from Babylon, Ezekiel had just announced to them, it's not going to happen. God's going to break Pharaoh's arm. Not only would Egypt be judged, but Israel's last hope, at least its last earthly hope, had failed. Prophecy number 6, lament for the fall of Pharaoh, chapter 32, verses 1 to 16. This message dated around March 3rd, 585 B.C., sometime after the exiles had received the news of the downfall of Jerusalem. It is a lament, a style used by Ezekiel several times in his prophecies. He uses the dirge more often than any other Old Testament prophet. As is often the case with prophetic dirges or laments, it is in part in anticipation of what is going to happen, and a recognition that since it is God's message saying it will happen, it's as good as done. I am somewhat amused, were it not so tragic, by the description that is given of Egypt early in this particular prophecy. Ezekiel says, let me tell you, Pharaoh, you view yourself as a lion. The majestic lion walking in the wilderness, king of the beasts. But you're not. Remember we talked earlier, we had an introduction to the sea monster, probably the crocodile, since it was the monster of the Nile. And God says, you're nothing but an old sea monster down there in the Nile, flopping around in the mud. Sort of different views, huh? I wonder what the difference is between the way we view ourselves and the way God views us. Want to know how God views us? Read the Word. The description of the judgment of the sea monster, verses 3 to 8, we looked at that earlier. This is a repetition of that. It does emphasize God's part in it. He says, I will cast my net over you. And it's not the fowler's net, it is the seaman's net, which, along with hooks, the way we discussed and saw last lesson, the common way of snaring the crocodile and bringing it out on the land where its flesh and blood would become food for the birds and the beasts. And Pharaoh's judgment would be part of the day of the Lord. He'd be snuffed out and extinguished, verses 7 and 8. The reaction of the nations, verses 9 and 10. Egypt's destruction is going to bring distress among the nations who saw it, but God would brandish the sword, which is Babylon, and the nations would tremble. The identity of the sword, again, is Babylon, verses 11 to 14. The ruthless, mighty men of Babylon would shatter the pride of Egypt. Verse 12, it would affect the cattle. Verse 13 and 14, it would affect the water. The water would not flow. It would be still and calm, just like oil. Verse 14, and then verse 15, the proof saying, when the land is made a desolation, then everybody's going to know that I am the one true God. And then conclusion, verse 16, everyone is going to chant Egypt's funeral dirge. But what's going to be the end of Egypt? Seventh prophecy, chapter 32, verses 17 to 32. This prophecy has been dated around April 1st. We're just right there. 585 B.C., two or three years later. It was not technically a funeral dirge, but again, it's a wailing song. And you tell the difference by simply looking at the meter. Strike that. Some folks do. I just write down what they wrote and believe it to be correct because it seems to be fairly consistent among those who do study Hebrew writing. The mourners were to bewail the descent of Egypt into the pit, verse 18, which represents the grave. Look down at verses 23 to 25 and verses 29 and 30. Egypt, we're told again, will go out down into the grave with the uncircumcised nations that represent all of the others who have suffered the judgment of God. And these nations would recognize Egypt's arrival as the fulfillment of God's judgment upon those who kill by the sword. Look at verses 19 to 21. There are going to be a lot of folks there in advance of Egypt. Ezekiel tells them, you'll have some company. Assyria is going to be there. Elam's going to be there. Meshach and Tubal will be there. Edom will be there. He goes through all of that, coming down through about verse 29. And all of these will be in the pit. You will wind up there. Now, you may say, well, how could that happen? Because God was using these people for His end. God, yes, uses evil to accomplish His purposes on occasion. But that does not mean that God overlooks or forgives the evil, unless proper steps are taken to obtain that forgiveness. Now with that in mind, let's have some concluding thoughts here on these prophecies against Egypt and against the nations. The oracles against the nations in Ezekiel 25 to 32 were originally delivered to the people of Judah. We read them and we say, well, God's talking to these seven cities that Eric discussed, and here He's talking to Egypt. And He doesn't seem to be talking to the people of Judah. But that is not correct. He is talking to the people of Judah, and everything that He is delivering here about these cities and nations is delivered for their benefit and for their instruction. And I think these words that are written serve at least three very important purposes. Number one, the oracles in Ezekiel 25 to 32. And keep in mind that this is an important part of Ezekiel. I don't know whether you've taken the time to stop and realize it or not. Ezekiel has 48 chapters. And out of those 48 chapters, 8 of them are wrapped up in these oracles or prophecies against the nations. The people who had helped to destroy the people of God. These oracles reveal God's judgment against the people who had a part in destroying God's people. God will deal with His people. But I'll take care of my children. You don't need to. Now, God may use and did use some other folks, but God brought punishment upon them as well. Number two, as with both the king of Tyre and the Pharaoh of Egypt, and you'll recall Eric's lesson where he talked about the king of Tyre and the pride that characterized him and the description that was given. As with both the king of Tyre and the Pharaoh of Egypt, God would throw them down from their self-elevated positions of power. There is no room for arrogance in God's creation. Did I say that slowly enough? If there's anything we need to learn, it is that. There is no room for arrogance and pride in God's creation. Number three, the oracles are essentially a dismantling of the gods of the nations, which in turn is a dismantling of the gods upon which the Hebrews, whether in Jerusalem or in exile, had begun to depend instead of depending upon the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, we haven't emphasized, at least I haven't as I've gone through these lessons, but if you read closely, you begin to see where in these prophecies certain language that is used addresses itself at least indirectly to saying, okay, here is Egypt's God, and what I'm doing to him says that God is no God. You know, you think the Athenians in Acts 17 had a lot of gods, even to the unknown God, in case they missed one? Egypt made them look like paupers. They had gods. Every city had multiplicity of gods. And God is saying, you know, you've got all these gods, you've got all these deities that are supposedly working for you. Let me tell you, I'm bringing judgment upon you. And Judah, you're going over here, you exiles, you've gone over here, even in Babylon, and you've gone and built your altars under every green tree and in every high place, and you depend upon those gods. Let me tell you, they're not going to do you any good. Oh, well, we're not idolaters. Who was it? I think somebody by the name of Paul talked about covetousness, which is idolatry. Do we worship the power of our nation and think that's our God? It'll protect us. There is one true and living God, and we best be on our knees before Him in obedience and in love. They will know that I am the Lord is a phrase that occurs in these prophecies 19 times. And that's the primary purpose, that everyone should come to know that I am the Lord, and let us remember that whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort of the Scripture, might have hope. May God bless us to that end. Thank you for your presence this morning.